Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're going to jump into looking at the DNC, what happened yesterday, what may be happening tonight with Bill Clinton, what all this portends for the election, some of the issues that we face in America, what the Democrats face, why it's different now than it was in 2008. A man has been writing a lot about that is Tom Schaller, of course, author of the book Whistling Past Dixie. Writes for the Baltimore Sun as a columnist, associate professor of political science at UMBC, and more. And Tom, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Great to be here, Mark.
And I understand we have Ray Abelia with us, who is co-director of Code Pink, Women for Peace, and co-organizer of Occupy APAC, Stolen Beauty Boycott of Ahava Cosmetics and Women Occupy. Ray, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you. Great to be on.
Great to have you here. In the studio, Tyrone Keyes, principal in the Maryland-based strategic and legislative consulting firm Arc Adeptus LLC. Good to have you in the studio.
Good to be here, Mark. Thank you.
And I understand that, I know, Ray, you can only stay for like 15 minutes or so, and then someone else will pop in. And, Tom, you're only here till 6, correct?
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's okay. Just making sure I got everything right. So we know just how to balance this conversation out. So let's jump into it. Tom, this is, I guess, before, just as we're going on, something popped up in my news where Chuck Norris has just said that Obama's election will unleash 1,000 years of darkness.
Yes, I saw that little quote. I think he does a little video with him and his wife.
Right.
I better rethink my vote, I guess. or get a lava lamp or something. One of those, plant lamps with the keep things a little brighter in my neighborhood.
So, all that aside, let me just start with you and then we'll turn to Ray. You've been writing, and what you wrote recently was this election of 2008, and you wrote, I think, a really interesting piece about why it's not 2012 was so different.
Yeah.
That what could have been a coronation speech, as you write, is not that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the real trick for Obama tomorrow night is to, make a case for his successful management of the government as he sees it. And, you know, he has to sort of walk this fine line between certainly not victory lapping and this whole business of are you better off from 4 years ago, which I think is actually demonstrably true. But he can't really run on a hopey, changey, 1984 morning in America Reagan kind of message because things have not turned around that quickly. But by almost every objective measure, things are better than they were in 2008. So you got to dance very carefully by, sort of taking credit where credit is due, not overstating the case, and making the argument that it would be bad to go in the other direction.
So I want to explore some of that in the time we have with you, but let me turn to Ray for a minute. I just want to lay some things on the table. And Ray, welcome. Great to have you on the show for the first time. We've had others from Code Pink on this first time with you. And I saw when you all were wrestled down and wrestled away at the RNC, and you had that gum on your suit. I saw someone threw at you. But talk a bit about what you're doing in the DNC and of your tactics and ideas and what you're presenting is different than what you've been talking about at the RNC.
Well, actually, we're bringing a very similar message to both the RNC and the DNC, and that's the message that we want money out of politics. We see way too much corporate and super PAC money going into this election, which influences our congresspeople to vote against the will of the people and in favor of things that benefit big corporations, like perpetual warfare, ongoing lack of health care for the American people, and foreclosures, et cetera. So we brought that message to both the RNC and the DNC, and we've also been protesting the ongoing war in Afghanistan and U.S. support for the Israeli occupation of Palestine at both the Republican and Democratic conventions. And then here in the DNC, it's actually taking place in Charlotte, North Carolina, which is home to the biggest, baddest banks, Bank of America and Wells Fargo. So we have a particular message around holding these big banks accountable. We say we've got to bust up the big banks, got to break them up, and we think people can take the first step by moving their money out of big banks and into credit unions and more local, sustainable banks.
So I'm curious, and I'd like to get Ray and Tyrone to respond to what I'm about to ask you, and then kind of I'm going to ask some questions about the convention after that before Tom has to go. There are some people who have argued, and correctly or incorrectly, about the effectiveness of demonstrations that get little publicity at places like the DNC or RNC? I mean, whether this is the most effective way to organize and fight for more radical change. I'm just curious how you would respond to that.
Well, I can just say from the Code Pink perspective, we've gotten tremendous publicity, both at the RNC and then here at the DNC. I think the RNC in particular was so boring for a lot of the mainstream media, and because it was delayed because of the hurricane, you know, we were the only action in the streets, and we were covered by AP, Reuters. We've been on Democracy Now! Almost every day. You know, I think it's been great, actually, from the PR perspective, to be creating a counter-narrative to these mega party conventions, which are backed by big corporations and have platforms that don't really represent the people.
And Tom, I'm curious, this is something that affects many conventions, and it hasn't hit in this convention as hard as it will in the next couple of days. What effect do you think it has?
Well, I'm actually of the mind anymore that the conventions are of declining significance, and by virtue of Labor Day and the Hurricane Isaac or Tropical Storm Isaac in Tampa, we are basically going to get 2 3-day conventions, and I wouldn't mind seeing that being the permanent state of affairs, maybe even a 2-day convention. There has been talk of that over the years for money-saving purposes. I guess when you fly all the way down there and you're a delegate and you've got your straw hat and it's a big event for you, you don't want to fly all the way down for just 2 days. And there's actually meetings before and after, so it'd still be a 3 or 4-day event, but it's sort of a 2-day televised event. You know, look, with the way that the country is polarized right now and the rigidity of the Electoral College in terms of how the states line up and there's so few states in play, I just don't see convention bumps being what they maybe once were. And so it just seems like to me it's a lot of waste of time. I think that what conventions are boiling down to now are proving moments for young and upstart candidates. Barack Obama in 2004, maybe Paul Ryan this year, though I think he did some damage to himself. You know, Mayor Castro last night was, you know, pretty dynamic. Chris Christie maybe last week. So now they're more proving grounds for future politicians than really changing the dynamics or a lot of voters' minds. Romney didn't get much of a bump, and maybe Obama will get a bigger bump. It seems like so far, at least after one night, their convention's going a little more smoothly. But, I think Rhea's right. I mean, it's about the media more than anything else, having something to talk about and write about and cover.
Which is the reason why, like Code Pink and others and the Undocubus can make a hit, because all the media is in town at the same time, Rhea, before you have to go, correct?
That's right, and I think it provides a useful opportunity to try to hold some elected officials accountable. Today, for example, we were outside of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee private special invite-only luncheon, and we saw tons of congresspeople, senators walking in. We got to speak with them directly and say, why do you continue to support all this money going to support Israeli war crimes and violations of human rights? So it's a special access to people in power that we might not get otherwise unless we were, you know, in the halls of Congress in Washington every day. And I agree that it's become somewhat of a charade when you see how much money is going into this election. There's kind of 2 conventions going on the ground here in Charlotte. There's the official one, and then there's all the private corporate-sponsored parties at night. And we're trying to just expose that and use it as an opportunity to expose the everyday way that politics is working in Washington.
Rhea, I know you have to run, and next time we'll have you on for longer so we can really get into some issues, into the thick of things. I appreciate you being part of the show.
Can I say something to Rhea before
she has to roll, though?
Okay. I just wanted to commend Code Pink, actually, because they're one of the few organizations that have been even-handed in their protest. Now, I don't agree with everything on their platform, but they have been even-handed throughout administrations, and I think they ought to be recognized for that.
Rhea Blia,
thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rhea. Rhea Blia is co-director of Code Pink Women for Peace, and we look forward to having her and the others back on. Tom and Tyrone, let me jump into this before we run out of time with you, Tom. At 410-319-8888, by the way, Both these conventions are theater.
Yeah.
Right? And seems to me that in some ways the Democrats seem to be more adept at putting on this theater than Republicans have been so far. But what does that really mean? What do you both think that really means? What do these conventions mean to the American people? What effect will they have on this election?
Well, I think that the conventions are pretty much a service that's being preached to the choir, pretty much. The faithful pay attention to these things, or junkies like the three of us, you know, we pay attention to it. But does it help sway any undecideds? I really don't think so. I've talked to a lot of people who are still undecided, and these conventions aren't doing anything to help them make up their minds one way or the other. I will say that the Democrats are more adept at the showcraft that it takes to put this on. You can see it from last night compared to last week. So I think that, you know, I agree with Tom. These are just pretty much coronation ceremonies these days. They're not the conventions of old where you had a good competition among credible candidates.
But Tom, so does it play beyond the convention? What does it mean when you hear a speech like Michelle Obama's or the speech you may hear tonight from Bill Clinton? And I mean, what effect does this have on the election? How does it play into this entire process beyond cheering, getting your troops motivated?
I don't think it does matter that much. I mean, it's true. There are a vast majority of voters, somewhere upwards of 90%, that for the most part have made up their mind already. Country's very polarized, and people are, even if they call themselves independent moderates, they tend to lean toward one party or the other, and they tend to make these decisions, you know, based on their identity, their personal identity and demographic characteristics and how that lines up with the promises and platforms of the two major parties. Doesn't mean that that 10% is unimportant, and they certainly are probably hyper-important in the sense that they're undecided and they're the swing people in the handful of swing states. It's really only going to be about 10 million people decide the election in 10 or 12 states. So, you know, do some of them turn in? If they may not watch it, but they'll watch the coverage of it, so they'll get bits and snatches. I think it's wrong to say it matters zero. But, you know, I think the conventions could be a little shorter and so forth. And it is. It's mostly a media event.
Neil Soroka is also with us now, press secretary for the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. He'll be staying with us through the next hour as well. Neil, welcome. Good to have you with us once again.
Great to be with you.
So, in looking at what we've seen, though, I mean, I've watched both conventions so far. I didn't go this year, obviously. We're here in Baltimore, but when you see let me take a step back here. When America sees these conventions, and they see who makes up the audience of both these conventions, does that have an effect on people beyond the speeches? I mean, when people look at the audience, because many people are watching who are not part of the committed, Tom Schaller, when you see an audience and that is at Democratic Convention, which is an audience that is kind of multiracial audience that you don't kind of have to kind of look around to find somebody of color in the audience, how does that affect America? How does that affect a base? What does it say about who we are and the divide between the two?
Well, it certainly reflects the differences between the two coalitions. You know, the Democrats are clearly the multicultural, multi-ethnic, and multiracial party, and the Republicans, despite a face here and there in the crowd, are largely white party, and increasingly so. And the country, of course, is getting less white, and this is a big problem for the Republicans, which is why they're trying to, you know, tinker with voter ID laws and what have you to try to maximize the voting power of a declining white voter base and older white voter base, and that makes up the modern Republican Party. But again, that's important, and it's reflected in when you turn on the TV and you see the cameras pan across the audience. But I don't think it's news. I think people already know this.
We've talked about this subject at length, the diversity within either parties. And yeah, sure, if television is a visual medium, so when you pan the camera around and you see black, brown, and other faces in the crowd, the electorate without the basis in history of both parties with regard to race, they internalize that, and it's very easy to see that that's a way that that's an advantage that the Democrat Party has in terms of bolstering the ranks of their supporters. But again, I think once you start to actually look at issues, facts, and whatnot, then it becomes a little less clear.
Neil?
I mean, listen, at the end of the day, what was it we found out last week? 2% of the delegates, those are 2% of the party activists that were at the Republican convention last week, were black. Says something not only difficult about the optics for the Republican Party of this convention, but difficult about the politics of the party. It's very hard to be a party that represents the interests of a multicultural, array of people, the real, melting pot, salad bowl, whatever you call it, of of America, if only 2% of the people that are involved in the writing of your party platform are folks of color. That's a big problem for Republicans. And I think that's something that, you know, as the last gentleman just said, you know, yeah, you're right. What's happening at these conventions is, largely being, controlled by folks who are dominant in society. But at the end of the day, when the folks writing the party platform, when the folks, who are running the party apparatus in various states aren't folks of color, you're just not going to find those interests represented in the party itself.
Well, that presumes, though, that people of color are monolithic in what they want from the government. And that, as we all know, is not the case.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that. They're certainly not monolithic. But the problem is, if you don't have a variety of voices, if those voices aren't present in the discussion, it's very unlikely that the interests of the wide array of people in any interest group are going to be represented.
Tom, again, let me jump in and get Tom back in here. I know you have to leave in a few minutes, and we can come back to some of the other issues after the top of the hour. One of these things that happens during these conventions is, as we talked about earlier, it trots out those who may be the future leaders of the party and those who may be running for president. We saw last night Julian Castro, mayor of San Antonio. The mayor of Minneapolis was on before that. Devon Patrick, who may not be a national candidate, maybe a senatorial candidate, whatever he ends up being. And you had Martin O'Malley. I wonder what you saw last night in those men and a couple of women who spoke, and what they say about what the future of the Democratic Party's leadership might be.
Well, I didn't see the governor's speech. I can see the transcripts because they get emailed out every speech from the floor. You know, you get gets.
You mean you weren't riveted all night long, Tom?
No, I wasn't. but I did watch Mayor Castro. I thought he was pretty impressive. Especially given his age, and it's clear that the party views him as a future leader, and given his age, that was kind of a Barack Obama 2004 moment for him to have the keynote speech. And obviously, the Latino vote is growing, and it's important and pivotal to both parties, but especially the Democrats' coalition. And Obama wouldn't be president without that 2/3 of the vote from Latino voters 4 years ago. So I was impressed by him, and I think when only Charles Krauthammer and Eric Erickson are moaning about Michelle Obama's speech, that's pretty much a home run. I mean, you had people from Fox News to NPR and everywhere in between saying it was, one of the best speeches they'd ever seen in a convention, no less from a first lady. And, I thought she was just pretty close to pitch perfect with a couple of exceptions. And so, I thought it was a good opening night. The Democrats are having some troubles today with their platform and stepping on their toes. We'll see how the big dog Bill Clinton does. He's usually pretty entertaining. And, I think you'll see some new stars come out of this, like Castro, that people start paying attention to.
Now, very quickly, how are they? What's happening on the platform that you saw today, where people are stepping on each other's on toes?
Oh, there was a big controversy about the role of Jerusalem and the use of the word God in the convention, and then Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's the party chairwoman, had to issue a statement, and so it's creating a. It's a kind of story that's really a media, D.C. Beltway kind of story. I'm sure it'll be reported in the news and in all these gaps in the coverage it'll be talked about today, but I don't think it's the kind of thing that makes a big deal in the average voter, and certainly not the undecided voters. It's kind of an esoteric thing, but, who knows? Maybe it's not going to be 1968, but these conventions don't run perfectly. You have a Clint Eastwood moment or you have a moment like this. Both parties usually want things to run perfectly, and they run somewhat less than perfectly.
And, we'll see what happens tonight and tomorrow night with the Barack Obama speech, which I think the Barack Obama speech of all will have to have an effect in this campaign. That's a campaign speech. This is the launch.
Yeah, and I think, I know I don't have a lot of time, and I'm trying not to step on others, but we'll have time when I get off the phone. But, I mean, the thing that I'll be looking for tomorrow is just, really how vocal and how strongly Obama defends things for which we know his poll numbers have suffered, like the stimulus, like the auto bailout, like TARP, even though he's blamed for that, though people with selective memories forget that though he supported it, it was passed under the previous administration, like Affordable Care Act. So, if you want to have a second term, You have to defend your first term. And if you're going to defend your first term, you can't do that without talking about the stimulus and the Affordable Care Act. And Republicans and Romney and Ryan think this is Obama's, you know, weakness, that this is his Achilles heel. And he has to turn that, you know, weakness. And from polling, I say that in an objective stance, right? There are weaknesses in his polling as a result of those policies. He is going to have to persuade the public that those aren't the failures that his opponents would make them out to be. And if he can't do that, I think he's going to have a hard time. And if he can do that, I think he's going to win, you know, not comfortably. I think he's going to win by a smaller margin than 4 years ago. But to me, that is task one. I mean, if you can't defend your own administration, then why should we reelect you?
Tom Schaller, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate you being part of the show.
Okay, sorry I couldn't stay longer.
We'll talk soon.
Cheers.
Cheers. Whistling Past 60 is his latest book. Columnist for The Sun and Associate Professor of Political Science at UMBC. We're going to come right back with our guest here with us, Neil Sroka, Press Secretary for the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Really come into the heart of this campaign and see what is going to happen next with these conventions that tell us. Tyrone Key stays with us. Corey McRae, who's co-founder of the Best Democratic Club, will join us as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to jump into a really interesting conversation here. We have with us Tyrone Keyes, Corey McRae, and Neil Sroka, taking a look at the DNC, what may happen tonight, what we thought of the speeches last night, if we think that Governor Martin O'Malley made his bid, become one of the presidential nominees for 2016 and more. 410-319-8888. Those of you listening in the Baltimore area, it's time for your traffic. Those of you listening elsewhere, just be patient. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenbaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention of and cure of cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org, or the number for more information is 1-800-888-8823. We are joined now by Neil Sroka, Press Secretary for Progressive Change Campaign Committee, Tyrone Keyes, Principal in the Maryland-based strategic and legislative consulting firm Arc Adaptus LLC, Corey McRae, co-founder of the Best Democratic Club. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And gentlemen, let's jump into it and get our listeners into this. I really want to see what people's reactions were to the speeches last night. You can join us with your thoughts about that. Michelle Obama's speech, I think very few people didn't think she knocked out of the park. I thought, Neil, one of the things I thought as an aside, watching her last night and thinking about Hillary Clinton, after this is all over, are we seeing a future senator? That's what I thought.
I mean, I mean, listen, I'm not sure Michelle would be interested in that sort of job. Frankly, I don't think she can take some of the nonsense that happens in the Senate sometimes.
But it was just it was really an amazing speech. And I think that it really did. The campaign, what happened last night, did what it was supposed to do. Excuse me, the convention, at least beginning to, which is really to rally the troops from progressive to conservative. Because what was interesting about this platform, Neil, then let's go around the room, is that the spectrum of voices last night, from beginning to end, and I did sit and watch all of it. I don't know if I'll get there tonight, but I watched all of it last night to see what was going on. And they were making clearly a pitch to Republicans by showing Republicans who have come over to the Democratic Party. They were clearly showing and pushing their efforts to bring the Latino vote and solidify that inside the Democratic Party, and making their stance around the pro-choice in America, about choice and abortion rights in America, making their stance around marriage equality. Neil, I mean, they were staking their claim out in very specific social areas.
Well, and I think that's definitely a hallmark of last night. I think tonight is going to be really interesting, and I hope I'm not jumping the gun here, but I think tonight, along those lines, is tonight will be the argument where the discussion of economic equality and economic really the progressive economic agenda is really going to be a front stage, and that's with the speech of Elizabeth Warren. She's going to have the keynote speech tonight, and what will no doubt be is just an amazing speaker, and you know, is really going to, I think, give a clear voice to what's happened in the previous administration, what happened in Barack Obama administration, and most importantly, what the future of the Democratic Party can be, and talk about someone who is going to be someone we're going to be talking about tomorrow. That's going to be Elizabeth Warren.
And let me, before I bring you guys in, let me just, out of courtesy, Delegate Mary Washington, who's a delegate to the convention as well, and a progressive member of the Maryland House of Delegates, progressive Democratic member of the Maryland House of Delegates, is on the phone with us. Mary, good to have you back here with us.
Great. Hi. Thank you so much. It's hard. There's a lot of lot going on here. I had difficulty getting a clear signal through. So it's great to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us for a few minutes. So long, you can stay as long as you like. We're going to have a rip-roaring political discussion here. You can stay or you can just add to us right now just what you're sensing. One thing we're talking about is, was the uselessness sometimes of conventions in terms of really being part of the political process. But what their real role is here is rallying the troops and setting a tone. So tell us what you're taking away from this so far.
I think you're right on. I mean, what happened last night was that we got our story of what we believe as Democrats and reminded us about why so many of us, remember, a lot of the people here are volunteers, are people who have dedicated themselves to public service. And so, you know, the people here, we have to get reminded because we get sort of in the weeds here at times of the day-to-day work that it takes to make change. And sometimes you forget the forest and the vision. And each speaker last night really hit those stories. I heard a little bit of what one of your guests was saying in terms of tonight, the focus on the economics of linking a social agenda and an economic agenda, and very clear that they're not in opposition. And so far, the speakers have made the connection that when you pass something like the Fair Pay Act, you're ensuring that women are treated equally and that they're heads of households, and that helps the economy. When men and women are able to marry who they choose and are able to protect their partners and their children, through marriage equality, that you are making sure that you're also protecting them economically. And then we just heard a speaker making the connection with small business and investing in small business and how small businesses are the key to the middle class. So I'm really excited, actually, for the first time in a long time, that my party is really willing to connect our social agenda to an economic agenda unapologetically. And I just really I admire the decision to just really to take on these issues.
And I think that
Tyrone Keyes.
We talked about this during the break. You know, the Democrats, they have the world's best orators, you know, in anywhere. When you leave a speech by a Democrat, it's like leaving church on Sunday morning or a Tony Robbins event. You're hyped. But then when you start to look at the facts, and the facts are that the campaign at this convention is going to talk about issues other than the main issue that's on the table, which is the current state of the economy. One of the guests that had to leave mentioned, I think incorrectly, that every demonstrable fact pointed to an improving economy. Not so. Gas prices are up 83%. Home values are down 30%. Median income is down. So these are facts on the ground that affect voters. The policy discussions that may be had at these conventions, the feel-good speeches, don't necessarily translate into support because of these facts.
Well, you know, this is interesting, and I'm going to say that I believe it's important to have a vision and policy, and I think that we are indeed consistent with our vision and our policy. And I'm going to correct you. If we roll back to 2009, our economy was hemorrhaging, over 800,000 jobs being lost. And by us, we're not losing and hemorrhaging jobs the way that we were after 8 years of a Republican administration. And again, if we look over the arc of the history of this country and the years in which Democrats were in control of the House or in control of the White House, and we compare that with Republican administrations, the ability for middle-class people and working-class people to actually have a chance of acquiring wealth through homes, through having fair wages, for being protected on the work site. If you lost a hand, that your employer didn't just kick you out on the street, they had to provide you with some type of workman's compensation. That you, if you were a woman working in the steel mill doing the same job, or African-American, making sure that you got paid the same thing. So, again, if we take a long view of history and not sort of the short-sighted right now looking a couple months out of an 8-year history or even a 60-year history of her common times, I think we can have a really good case that moderate Republicans and Democrats have done a lot to really move us forward.
And with respect, Delegate. With respect, I do understand all those things, but you started out by saying you were going to correct me. The facts I mentioned were gas prices, median income, and home values. Those are facts. I mean, they're undisputable. And while I do understand everything you said, it does not excuse the fact that these issues have risen up, and they are important in the lives of individuals.
So, but let me just finish.
Just one second, because I can't leave this one part out.
Go ahead, and we have to get the other guests as well. Go ahead.
Sorry about it.
Good. So finish what you're going to say, Delegate.
Yes, just again, our energy policy and why gas prices are allowed and all types of energy has everything to do with the attempts of the Republican Party and some very conservative Democrats to allow these industries to go unregulated.
And so but let me do this. I'm curious what you've just heard, Neil Sorka, then we're going to turn over to Corey McRae. As someone who represents an organization that pushes and backs progressive candidates around the United States of America, what's a progressive Democrat response to what you just heard?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what we're actually starting to see is a really important critique coming through. What came through last night, and frankly needs to come through even more so through the next few days of this convention, is Democrats need to demonstrate, and especially progressive Democrats, need to demonstrate to the American people just why we haven't had the gains that we wanted to have in the last 4 years. In a lot of ways, progressives have spent the last 4 years frustrated, much like many Republicans and independents and other Democrats across the country, because things aren't moving fast enough. And part of the reason is because Republicans, every step of the way, have obstructed this president's agenda, have obstructed the agenda of Democrats, and obstructed and gotten in the way of the things that actually need to happen to get things done. You know, the president was initially hoping for, and folks were targeting, a $1.2 trillion stimulus in order to get the economy started again. And when push came to shove, and when you had to deal with the intractable Republicans, the actual cost and the actual direct investment in the economy went down to a fraction of even the smaller stimulus that actually passed. So really what needs to happen here is Democrats need to have the courage of their convictions and say, listen, the Republican obstruction stopped the president from actually delivering on the plan that he wanted to deliver on. And it's our job not only to reelect the president, but to push him in the next term to actually do the things we want him to do in office.
So this is, I think folks, I really do want to join us out here. 410-319-8888. We'll get to, I see Bruce has been holding on since the last hour, but let me get him on here as well. 410-319-8888 is the number. Corey, you want to jump in and then we'll do that.
I just wanted to say that I thought that it was a remarkable speech by our First Lady, Michelle Obama. And just like the delegate said, Delegate Washington touched, you know, she touched on young people. I felt like she was talking to me. She touched on the debt that she acquired from college education. That's why they were fighting to keep it down. And one of the things she distinguished was the difference between the two families, that she didn't walk in. She explained the room that she lived in. She explained how her mother thought that it was a lot of things. Sometimes going out in the back was a happy moment for them. But she also touched on the patience. You know, even sometimes when she feels as though it has to happen right now, our President Barack Obama always delivers that patience that it needs to get that bill passed or proposed, which I think that the delegate was talking about, was that time and that patience is very crucial. And then Neil, I think Neil Sikora touched on, you know, we as progressive Democrats have to always keep that pressure, even if we do support that candidate, because that's what I always say. That's the difference between good and great, is the pressure that we apply to that candidate.
So this is, let me ask something about to all of you about this, whether it's and what you think, your analysis of why Democrats are not doing this, and what you think about, and what you all three think about why Democrats are not doing this as well. I've been harping on this poll ever since it came out, but to me this is one of the most significant political polls to come out in a very long time. It's a poll put out by Suffolk University of unlikely voters. Have you all seen the? Did you see the poll, Neil?
No, I haven't seen this one.
I'm going to send it out to all of you.
Okay.
It'll be on our website as well. They did a poll of polling the, obviously not all, but there are 90 million voters who will not be voting this election, 10 million more than before, registered and unregistered, unlikely voters. And in that poll, it said 43% of unlikely voters, if they were voting, would have voted for Barack Obama. 23% would have gone to a third party. 14% for Mitt Romney. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that say to you all about what the Democrats are not doing, about what they're not doing to even garner the votes that are out there that should belong to them, but they're, and also why they've turned off 10 million more voters since the last election? There was 80 million last election, 90 this election, almost all those 10 million were Democratic voters who went, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what I'll say, this is Neil. What I'll say is that.
One at a time. So, Neil, you started, and let me let Neil finish his thought, and then everybody else can jump in. Go ahead, Neil.
Sure. Yeah, what I'll say briefly is that what I think it reflects is a populace, and you know, particularly a group of Democrats and that are hungry for real leadership and someone who's really going to fight for the middle class. I think the president, and not only fight for the middle class, but visibly fight and take on some of these people that are, you know, obstructing, you know, preventing him from getting the things done that they elected him in office. I think a lot of the frustration from voters, especially those who aren't going to vote this next time around, is because they feel like they got all wrapped up in this last election in 2008. And, you know, the candidates didn't deliver the change that they expected or the change that they wanted. Now, some of that is the president's fault for sure, but a lot of it isn't. It's due to the Republican obstruction that we were talking about earlier. And what they really want, what those folks or voters are really hungry for, are a president that would make that argument, articulate the problem, and demonstrate to them just, just what he's up against. And I think that's what needs to happen, and I think that's the kind of thing, that's the kind of action And that's the kind of rhetoric that we're going to need in order to get folks back to the polls and get folks excited again. But in the end, we're going to need results. It's got to be more than rhetoric. It's got to be more than just talking about fighting. The president's going to need to show that he's fighting.
And I will agree. I will agree with
Tyrone
a portion of what Neil said, that the president overpromised and has so far underdelivered. There was a lot of soaring rhetoric. He'll heal the planet by virtue of him being elected. The sea levels will adjust and everything in between. And every first-time used car salesman knows you underpromise and overdeliver. So what the president did was created a tremendous amount of apathy in the process. A lot of the new voters did not get even a scintilla of what they thought they were going to get, right or wrong. And I will, I want to speak, because Neil's brought it up twice now, the obstructionism aspect. The president, let us not forget, the president had a Democrat Congress, House and Senate, in the first 2 years of his term. And it is not the Republican Senate that won't pass his budget. It is a Democrat Senate. So there are hold on one second.
There's something called a filibuster.
No, sir. No, not with a budget. You need a simple majority to get a budget passed in the Senate. You can't filibuster a budget resolution in the Senate. No, you cannot.
So, all right, but let me get your take.
I think that while Tyrone focuses on the first 2 years, we still also have to keep in mind the last 2 years, and they were obstructionists those last 2 years. And then as we talk about the unlikely voters in the poll that you just talked about, what I would like to see is what was the age range of those people that were unlikely voters, because they probably are young people, which is a different generation, and those Xers are pretty much, I want immediate results, you know. And one of the things that we had at this time was that they were pretty much taken out the game, I guess, after that 2008 election. And this is the first time that I saw real people get back into it. You know, my Twitter feed, the Facebook last night, those were regular people that's not usually engaged in the process. But what my generation has to realize, just like any game of chess, there's a beginning, there's a middle, and there's an end game. And right now, when we're electing somebody, we're in the beginning and the middle stage, but that pressure comes in the end game. So we have to not take ourselves or draw ourselves out. We have to keep on applying that pressure to the people that we elect.
And Mary, did you want to jump in with an idea? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the two things. First, on the undeliver me, this is amazing, the standard to which this president is being judged by. And I have to question why that is. And I think you need to think about why that is, that you would be so willing, and that so many people are so willing to doubt his abilities when he's demonstrated time and time again. Many of us have been in this situation, and yet somehow we're being held different to a standard than anybody else that has ever held the position. So what has he delivered? Many administrations have attempted to pass health care reform. In fact, people said, hey, leave it alone, it's dead on the ground. And everyone's not happy with it necessarily, but we have many more people are going to be covered. Being a female is not going to be a pre-existing condition upon which you could be denied coverage. We're not going to have caps on benefits, so that when people have catastrophic injuries or have children that are born with disabilities, they're not going to be bankrupted. And then, again, you know I'm not a hawk, but we spent so much time and money searching for Osama bin Laden, and he got him. I mean, and there are many more things that we actually did accomplish. So I have to, you know, question that. Now, on the other side, in terms of what our party has not done, I would say, over the last 30 years, is that I think we really bought the idea that if we were Republican-like, that somehow people would move towards us and gravitate us. If we would move, away from actually the very progressive ideas of Lyndon Johnson and some of the earlier people, and as you see this kind of slow drift towards the center, it really was a place where people stopped, I think, seeing a difference. And I think this election, like no other that we've seen in a long time, there is clear differences between what Democrats are saying and what Republicans are saying. There's absolutely a difference, and it's a difference that, you know, I see and can actually believe in for the first time in a long time.
Well, here's what our listeners think at 410-319-8888. Are you among the disillusioned who are not voting? Are you voting for Mitt Romney? Are you voting for a third party? Are you voting for Barack Obama? What's your take on what you saw in the last couple of days here and yesterday at this convention and what you saw last week? Does that affect how you feel or think about what you've seen? Well, go ahead, Corey, and I'm going to get to the phones.
And I just want to say two more things. You know, that extra $20 that a person got in their pocket, the middle class got in their pocket from the and also hearing Lily Ledbetter. Hearing her speak was very remarkable. I thought that was a great piece, and that was a great piece of legislation that our president passed. And I just wanted to make them extra comments for the delegate there, just to add.
So, and I know there are a lot of folks in here who want to join this conversation. Let me get them in. I want to give a great deal more time to Tyrone, since the way it ended up being balanced out here, we didn't expect this, with three progressive Democrats and Tyrone by himself, which is not how we planned it out at the beginning. 410-319-8888. Bruce, you've been holding on. You're on the air.
Yeah. Evening. How you doing?
Very well.
Man, I've been holding on 55 minutes. So
40 minutes, actually. But go ahead.
Well, anyway, so in some of the conversation I've heard about the spectrum of voices and diversity of voices, and I agree 100%. And I disagree with the interpretation of voter suppression, but I'll give you a real indication of voter suppression, not a perceived interpretation of voter suppression. It's been going on for years, for decades, in the state of Maryland, and has to do with Maryland state law. I'm registered as an independent voter, which, according to Maryland state law or Maryland state charter, in any election, city, state, or national, in the primary, if there isn't an independent registered candidate running for a position, mayor, councilperson, senator, congressman, whatever it is, I'm not allowed to vote in the primary, so my vote, my voice is being suppressed in order to exercise who actually makes it to the general election. But the legislator won't, the Maryland state legislator won't do anything about it because the two-party system wants to have a monopoly on what's going on. And both parties, Democrat and Republican, that's why I don't want to be corrupted by either one of their parties. They throw up all kinds of obstructions that limit the possibility of independent candidates even getting on the ballot, and then add to that redrawing of district lines and precinct lines. That's voter suppression. Because anybody knows that whenever you deal with any enterprise with the government, if you want to get a building permit, which I got 2 months ago, you want to buy, you want to get a fishing license in person,
right,
you want to get social, any type of social benefits, you have to show up with some type of ID card with your photo on a driver's license or state issued card. That's not voter suppression. That's a privilege and a right that should be protected.
Well, Bruce, let me just correct you here. For one thing, I do. My wife would agree with you. She's a registered independent, and she's angry that she cannot vote in primaries as she can do in other states, as she has in the past, and choose Republican and Democrat. I think that is something that I think that the state should rectify. I agree with you completely. That's absolutely. I think I don't know if our guests agree with that or not, but I completely agree with that.
I would agree with
it. But I think that. Yeah. Comparing that to these new laws, you've never had to show a state issued ID to vote in elections in this country, in this state, and in most states in America. You do not have to show it. People register to vote, come up with their registration card. If they can ask, they can ask for that if they wanted. No one's ever shown this. The people who do not have those registered, do not have voter IDs, who don't have state voter IDs. Are people who are senior citizens, mostly communities of color, poor people, don't have those IDs, they don't have license, they don't drive, and that's the reality. And this is voter suppression that is part of a huge effort by Republican governments, especially in the South and some places in the North, to keep minorities and others from voting.
Let's suppose
here is that this is a law. This is a law designed to fix a problem that doesn't exist. This is equivalent to having leash laws for unicorns. It is a nonsensical law. There is actually no systemic demonstration of any problem with our voting system. So there's no reason for voter ID laws.
Actually, several states may disagree with that statement in terms of turnout that has been over and above. If you take Chicago, for example, they've got documented cases of people who are actually deceased casting a vote. Now, let's talk about...
Tyrone.
Let's talk about the ID piece.
But the reality is that they found 96 instances of voter fraud out of 100 million people voting. It doesn't exist. It's there for a simple reason. The simple reason is to keep mostly Democratic voters away from the polls and to steal the election.
These are all red herrings. My 93-year-old grandmother had a state ID. She needed it in order to go to the get her Social Security check deposited into her bank account. The state ID in Maryland, at least, and Maryland is one of the more expensive states, costs $15. Do you know anyone without a state ID that's above the age of 18? If you do, they can't participate in society because they can't cash a check. They can't open a bank account. And when you're required to show ID to, say, get into the Democratic National Convention, you can't even present it then, and they're requiring it. So I'm not sure why.
I'm saying people with college IDs, different things.
Go ahead, Neil.
The big difference there is that it is not a right for someone to enter the Democratic National Convention. It is a right in this country for citizens to be able to vote. So it is, you know, that's a red herring if there ever was one.
Do you know anyone without a state ID, sir?
I know lots of people who have state IDs in certain states, yes.
I don't know any here because they want to participate in commerce and in the society in general.
What I'm saying, and you know what, I don't know anyone, but just because I don't know anyone without an ID doesn't mean I think we should have a new law in order to allow to force them to have ID.
And that's a separate thing, and that's fine. My point is the big ballyhoo about the difficulty of obtaining a state ID is it's just hilarious.
Wait,
actually.
Except we stop talking. I mean, just really, I hear what you're saying, but I think a lot of it is kind of, and I have a lot of respect for you, but you know that. But I think a lot of it is kind of Republican rhetoric, and
And you know, I'm not a Republican.
I know you're not a Republican,
right.
But in places like Texas, where this is taking place, and Mississippi, there are millions of people without IDs. People don't need them. They don't use them. They don't have them because they don't drive. They don't have. There's cases of people in their 90s who never had reason for an ID, don't have them, but they've been voting all their lives. This isn't, and the places where you get state IDs are not open. They've also done things for voter suppression beyond that by closing down and narrowing the time people can vote for extended voting. Extended voting is something that is used primarily. 50% of all the African-American voters in Florida voted during extended hours. They ended those extended hours and ended them on the weekends. That's only there to suppress voter turnout that Republicans feel will go against them. That's why they're there.
I think it was Pennsylvania, too, where I guess the judge threw it out.
Same thing, Pennsylvania.
And I'm not – if they've done that with the extended voting hours, then okay, that's a separate issue altogether. But the case I'm making is that I think that every time I hear this ID issue
– Have you ever been asked for an ID when you voted?
No, I never have. But I have been asked for an ID if I wanted to do business with a bank or I have to have one to participate in society.
But what about the other measures that they have set up in reference to saying what your address is, saying what's
– Well, anything that's akin to a poll tax or a poll test is obviously something that we don't want to go back to because that's just flat out wrong. So I'm not advocating that. And I'm not flat out eschewing – showing an ID either. I'm just saying
we have two separate issues. Folks, we have tons of callers, and we're going to get to those callers and come back to our discussion. I'm going to figure out where this election takes us now, what we think is going to come out of these conventions, and what that really means for these elections coming up November 6th. 410-319-8888. We have on hold here June, Troy, Clarence, in that order. We'll get to all your calls, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zine. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. We are joined by Neil Sroka, press secretary for the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, Tyrone Keyes, principal of the Maryland-based strategic and legislative consulting firm ArcAdaptus LLC, and Corey McRae, co-founder of the Best Democratic Club. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And I said we'll go right to the phones. And June, you're on the air.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hi. I am a Baltimore City School high school history teacher. So I am trying to impress upon our young people the importance of the vote and not to give up on our system, no matter how corrupt it appears. Now, I'm definitely a diehard Democrat, even though they've disappointed me many times. But to be an independent really has no clout, because independents never get elected. So we have to face that reality. The other thing is, as for Obama's first 2 years, he is so intelligent, but he was a bit naive because he thought in the first 2 years he could bring both parties together and show that he was a president for all the people, not just the Democrats. And we see where that got him, right?
Yep. Yeah, and June, I appreciate you, the call, and I think let me turn to the Democrats. Well, all three are Democrats actually in this room, but let me turn to the two supporters of Barack Obama in this room. How's that? I mean, was that a strategic mistake? I mean, Barack Obama. One of the reasons many people were turned off because some people thought that Barack Obama did not fight hard enough for the things that he campaigned for in the election. He said a couple things in the election, like. He said he believed in the public option, would fight for it. Didn't do it. He said that I will put on my walking shoes and walk the picket lines with union workers on strike. He didn't do it. I can name a dozen others, but is that part of what's going on here, Corey?
I think that does raise a level of discussion with a certain amount of people because, like you said, those hardcore progressives, that's what they wanted to see. You know, and I think that sometimes we do, as the delegate stated, we focus on that base and think that if we act like Republicans sometimes or do certain things in the middle that it will bring it back home. But I think that to a certain degree, he did more than that other candidate would have done, you know, and it's a lot that he has done. I think that we shouldn't always focus on the tough parts because he was a candidate. He was candidate Obama at that time. Sometimes you're not aware of everything that you can do, and sometimes the challenges that you meet while you're trying to do that is very challenging, and you have to come up with compromise. Life is about compromise, and that's where he had to focus on. But when you do get a chance, I wanted to swing back to some of the good things that Maryland adored because I want to let everybody know we're not one of them states that's trying to stop people from voting.
But, you know, I would actually agree with you, Corey, that, you know, the realities of life as the president do not lend themselves to you going out and walking a picket line. I mean, and we as voters have to understand that each candidate is going to say certain things that we kind of take with a grain of salt because we know even if he gets elected, it's probably impractical. So I will actually give the president a pass on some of the things that he went into the presidency with the mindset he could do. I think all candidates do that to an extent. So I don't think he was any different in that. And I think he honestly believed he could go down there and change the tone in Washington. And he quickly learned that bureaucracy and that machine is bigger than any individual, even the president of the United States. And it showed him that he couldn't change the tone.
And you talked about the walking shoes, and me being from the IBEW, I really wanted to see that. But I understand politics, and we saw what happened down there with Governor Scott Walker and him being reelected. What would have been the repercussions of him joining in that fight and saying what he did say? I think Hilda Solis did show up, though. I noticed she participated in the pickets and things like that. But what was the repercussions if our president did join?
Neil Soroka, what are your thoughts?
I think that, and it's one of the things that I am, you know, disappointed in the president. You know what? I can understand not wanting to maybe get involved in the political campaign, but there's absolutely no reason why the president didn't show up in February of 2011 when a whole host of people from around Wisconsin and across the country were, protesting the attack on government workers that Scott Walker was executing. And that was a real loss for us, a loss for labor, and I think a loss for the president because it was a real failure to not only follow through on his commitment to working people, but a commitment to the American people to walk the picket line. I think, one of the other problems that the president has, and you guys talked about, him having a rough first 2 years, thinking he could bring the party together. Well, the problem is there's this continued fetishization in the White House about bringing parties together to do big things, even if they're the wrong thing. And a great example is, you know, last week we read in the New York Times and Washington Post that, you know, the president was saying, his advisors were saying he was looking forward to essentially cutting Medicare and Social Security in the process of doing some sort of deal with Republicans. Well, that's not what people want. You know, those kind of cuts are not popular. And people want, you know, a chance to find common ground. They want, candidates to find compromise, but they want to compromise without compromising their values. And when we talk about doing a deal just for a deal's sake when it comes to our budgetary issues and not, you know, thinking through
the repercussions of cuts to Medicare or Social Security benefits. Yeah, I think Democrats and progressives and Democrats are right to be concerned about that, and are right to have concerns about the president when, you know, he talks about doing deals for deals' sake.
Yeah, I think you're mischaracterizing the president's thrust in doing that, though. He wanted to look toward ways that the program could be preserved long term. He was never talking about doing anything that would affect anyone that is retired currently or nearing that stage.
Well, if that's the case, he can clarify it really simply by just stating clearly for everyone, I will not agree to cuts to Medicare or Medicaid or Social Security benefits. There are tons of ways we can find efficiencies. There are ways we can improve these programs and cut costs and deal with the very real budgetary problems we have in this country. But we should be doing it without talking about cutting benefits.
410-319-8888. Troy, you're on the air.
Yes, how you gentlemen doing?
Very well, welcome.
When he first got elected and he won his election, I knew right then and there that he was going to have a rough time. And I believe everybody knew it. No matter what he said, that all his promises he couldn't keep. All presidents do that. But when he got elected, I made my mind up right then and there I was going to be in it for the long haul. So I want him to go 8 years, because if we went the 8 years of everybody else, why can't we do it for him? Why is it so hard for him to be, you have to go through so much? We should be ready to deal with it. We knew it was coming. We knew that they weren't going to help him out. So it shouldn't be no surprise right now that all these leaders, everybody, particularly African-American people, he haven't done this, he haven't done that. You knew it wasn't going to happen. So deal with reality and just buckle down and help him go another 4 years. You will be okay.
Okay. The one thing I'd like to say to the gentleman is with economic numbers like this, presidents haven't gone 8 years. Hoover, Carter, and Bush the Elder were voted out of office with numbers, some of which are similar to the ones that we're seeing now.
So let's wrestle with that for a minute, and we'll go back to Clarence and Karen, next couple of callers up. And we're going to get to both of those calls, and the other ones coming in as well. But, Neil, I mean, how do Democrats respond to the economic crisis facing America, the unemployment, the people who have stopped looking for jobs, the fact that most of the jobs that have been created are low-wage jobs, not jobs that people can raise families on. So this is – people are fearful out here. I mean, that's so how does Barack Obama, how do the Democrats turn that around?
I think the way you turn it around is, number one, acknowledging the scope of the problem. There is no doubt that middle-class incomes have gone down, but this is a problem that's been happening since 2000. As the caller said, the last caller said, we gave President Bush 8 years to screw it up. I think we can give Barack Obama another 8 years to figure out how to clean up the mess that was created under that administration. Now, that said, what really needs to happen and what we should be expecting out of this president in the future is nothing less than a 100% commitment to fight on behalf of the working Americans. And that's, doing things like I just said, like agreeing, stating very clearly an opposition to any cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security benefits, the benefits that, families rely on as they get older, for themselves and for their family members. But also, we should be pushing for, passage of a Jobs Act and, maybe even a Full Employment Act. There, we could spend, about a half of the amount of money we spend for the, entire Department of Defense, and it could employ every single person in this country who wants a job, in some cases privately and in some cases publicly. And that's something that we should be considering. There is a real, real jobs problem in this country. And one of the ways we're going to do it is by, passing forward-thinking legislation that actually ensures that everyone gets a job.
410-319-8888.
I just want to say Neil's correct. I think that the IBEW, August 11th, they had their second Bill of Rights in reference to job issues to make sure that we could protect workers and different things such as those. But what we definitely, I think the message that we need to focus on is that, do you want Mitt Romney? The choices are Mitt Romney and the Barack Obama. Do you want him at the other side of the table? Michelle said it clear. We've experienced it where we had college debt. We've experienced it where we've had a certain amount of income. We've experienced community organizing. And you got a guy where he thinks that it's okay to get that loan from your father to start that company. And, he walked in the door with millions of dollars. Do we really understand the rank and files person or people? how they feel on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, so the lack of money and poverty, while it may be a virtue, having money and the ability to go to a family member and ask for a loan is certainly not evil.
It's not evil, but it's not a reality
not
to everybody.
To everybody. You're absolutely right. And I thought that we were going to get through the hour. I was just making a mental note of a lot of the discussion we've been having has revolved around defending the president's record or lack thereof with regard to the economy. And we haven't really brought Mitt Romney up at all. So this again proves to me that the White House, or the campaign more specifically, is on the defensive with this entire issue. You can't talk about anything in the economy that can relate to the people that is better than it was 4 years ago. And as James Carville said back during one of the Clinton campaigns, it's the economy, stupid.
Well, here's what I'll say about that. I think part of the reason why we haven't talked about Mitt Romney is because most of the folks on this panel understand just how disastrous the policies of Mitt Romney would be if he were elected. We saw what happened in Bush, and we know not only does Mitt Romney, in example of taxes, let's talk, not only does Mitt Romney want to keep Bush's tax cuts, he wants to go even farther and give even more tax cuts to the rich people. So I think one of the reasons why we haven't talked about Mitt Romney and we've been so focused on Barack Obama's record is just because it's obvious. It's clear whose side Mitt Romney's on. It's not on the side of working families. And it's clear just how disastrous. We just lived through the disaster of the Bush administration and its fallout. And we know it's pretty clear to most voters exactly what Mitt Romney would do.
Yeah, the disastrous Bush administration that never saw unemployment above 7.8%. Right.
Until the administration went to skyrocket.
Until the last month of his term.
It was phenomenal timing, really, for him to ensure that he could leave office just as the economy was important.
I'm sure he planned it that way.
One never knows. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, good evening.
Good evening, Clarence.
You know, referring to people not voting, how many times can you kick people around? It's not so much as Barack Obama. The election of Barack Obama pretty much showed the country just how dysfunctional the government was. I've said this before, we have democracy operating under capitalism. You know, the script has been flipped. The Supreme Court kicked the whole country in the face with their decision. Then all of a sudden you have voter rights suppression come up. That's another slap in the face. The system just keeps kicking us around. It shouldn't be stressful for pulling teeth to elect the president in this country. It's sinister, as Governor O'Malley so eloquently put it, the whole thing is sinister. These people, as it was put to me, are socially repugnant on both sides. When the Democrats were in control, we didn't get the money taken out of politics. We didn't get any of the things we want when they were in control. So how many times do you expect people have, a lot of people have just decided, well, I'm not even going to deal with this. Me, I'm a fighter. I'm going to get my behind up and I'm going to go vote. But you have disillusioned people so much in this country until they just look up at it like, how's my one vote going to go up against $100 million? You know, it has a psychological effect on the country at whole. And yes, getting a driver's license or ID can be difficult sometimes. That's why you have check cashing places running around that says check cash, no ID required, you know? So, I mean, what do we do? How do we flip the script back around? Are we going to send the military over to China to forcibly bring our jobs back? So there's so much subterfuge. Like subterfuge. There's so much subterfuge going out there it turns people's heads, you know? So what do we do? There's no answer to this. If the vote doesn't work, if you have people actively going around like Karl Rove and sitting around thinking of how he's going to subvert the system, we're lost. Thank you, Mr. Stein, for my comment.
Thank you, Clarence. I think that we probably won't do anything with China as long as they remain the biggest foreign buyer of U.S. debt securities. No matter what Mitt Romney says about taking on China, I doubt he would do it for fear of what the retaliation would be.
And Mr. Clarence talked about voter suppression, but like I said, I always like to talk that Maryland isn't one of the states that's trying to do a lot of the things. Just keep in mind that you can register at the age of 16. You just have to be 18 to vote. We just started online voter registration. That's a big thing. Ex-offenders, it's a big myth that ex-offenders can vote, but about 5 or 6 years ago, as long as you're not on parole or probation, you do have the right to vote. Where we find Pennsylvania and Florida are trying to limit early voting, we do have 5 early voting days, and 2 of those days are Saturday and Sunday. So just keep in mind that the state of Maryland is trying to push in the right direction.
And I also would agree with the caller that there's too much money in politics. I think everybody on the panel would agree to that. And it does make one wonder, you know, if all of this influence is coming in via these corporations and very wealthy people who do not relate to the rank and file of the Democrat or Republican Party, because, you know, Democrats like to characterize all Republicans as being rich, which they know is not the case. But if you've got all of this money coming into these parties, then what is the average voter to think about the value of their single vote?
Let's try to get on the caller. Karen in Edgewood, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to say that the people who are not going to go out to vote and the people who think that President Obama has not done a very good job, I think they're very politically naive and they don't understand how bureaucracy works. For one person to, after 9, 10 presidents, try to get a health care bill passed, and for him to take the opportunity and to pass this bill, history will tell how much impact this will have on our country in terms of our health. So for one person to make the hard decision to bail out the auto industry when you had naysayers saying, let it go, Romney saying, let it go, for one person to give the call and take the chance to take out Osama bin Laden after he killed all our people there in New York, and you say he hasn't done anything? Afghanistan, he said, we're going to get people out of there. He's done that. For one person to keep us from going into a depression and people to understand that and to allocate money for education, so people will be able to go to community colleges in order that they can get jobs right now, and for people and for one person, the first thing he did when he got in office was to sign the equal pay bill for women. You must be kidding. And supporting, you know, and giving money to small business.
All right, okay.
And the Dream Act, you know, helping people who have been here for years who have been born in this country. And you're saying that he hasn't done anything?
Yes, ma'am. I'm saying that he hasn't done enough. I am. I'm actually saying that I have friends that are serving in Afghanistan, so I'm sure they're not over there on their own accord. So there are still people at war in the country. There are economic numbers out there that would indicate that the president certainly has not done enough. And I, for one, am not too big on giving a person an additional 4 years when the previous 4 years that they were given, they have not improved the situation. So we have a difference of opinion, but we can agree and do so agreeably.
And Neil, let me get some thoughts. We only have about a couple minutes left. I'd like to, you and Corey to kind of close out here with your thoughts about where you think this election is going to go and what you think is going to come out of all this, out of the convention, and what do you think? I mean, I think many people are looking at saying November is such a toss-up, given all the issues we've talked about. No one can clearly predict what's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think, listen, it's going to be a close election. I think what's really going to make the difference in a lot of these races are, you know, not only sometimes the president has coattails. People talk about the president having coattails and bringing in, you know, additional Senate and House races. I think in some cases, and particularly a great example being up in Massachusetts, I think, you know, folks running for Senate may have some coattails. Someone like Elizabeth Warren, who's giving voice to you know, these economic issues, these progressive economic issues that others just haven't. I think she, you know, folks like her very well could bring out additional people to the polls. And I think that's people want, you know, and like we'll see, Elizabeth Warren is speaking tonight during prime time at the convention, and I think she will articulate the kind of economic vision for the country and really kind of articulate the problems that many folks are facing across this country in a way that very well could not only bring people to her side, but also bring people to Barack Obama. She described, you know, her work setting up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the work that happened under the Obama administration to, you know, limit the predatory lending and predatory credit card companies. So, you know, I think what will be interesting is how these Senate races and how these House races impact impact the presidential election this fall and the back and forth between all of the races.
Very quickly, I have about 30 seconds left.
I think that I'm excited about Elizabeth Warren. I think that this is what wakes up the regular people that's living day-to-day lives. Like I said, my Facebook and Twitter feed was definitely pumping yesterday, and I'm pretty excited. I'm ready to get in the game.
All right, I want to thank you all. Neil Sroka, Press Secretary, Progressive Change Campaign Committee, and Corey McRae, co-founder of Best Democratic Club, and Tyrone Keyes, principal of the Maryland-based company Adaptus LLC, ARC Adaptus LLC. Good to have all three of you
with
us.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
On to the polls. We'll continue this coverage and appreciate all of you calling in and writing in and making the show what it is. On the way out of here, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, 1-800-638-7781. If you are a first or second time home buyer looking for a home in Baltimore, the number is 1-800-638-7781. Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Justin Levy. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Mark Gunnery, and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern is Latrice Eddy. Welcome, Latrice. Tim, good to have you with us. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To podcast this show, find out about our guests, the work they do, the articles they've written, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.